Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm spending the entire show rebroadcasting an interview I did with Stuart Kaminsky, a writer, a lecturer, a teacher, a consultant, a friend. Stuart died at 75, and if you are a fan of mystery fiction in any way, you know who he is, and I don't have to tell you. If you read the newspapers, you've read the many, many, many accolades bestowed upon him. I can tell you that he was a singular voice, a man who could say to a room full of people who didn't believe it that there's no such thing as good and bad, at least in film. There's only what you like and what you don't like. And when everybody kept saying to him, what about this film? It's a classic. Everyone knows it's the best. It's really good. Stuart insisted that judgments of these kind were all relative. There was no good. There was no bad. There was only what you liked. And everyone who had anything to do with Stuart Kaminsky liked him. So the interview is just about an hour long. I'm not going to say another word. I am simply going to play the last interview I did, not that very long ago, with Stuart Kaminsky. Okay, so I'm here with Stuart Kaminsky in his lovely living room, while his lovely wife is cooking a Bhutanese chicken dish for 100 women.
Correct.
Amazing. Perhaps we will hear the sounds of cooking as we do this interview.
Very likely. We're near the kitchen.
Yes, that's correct. We are near the kitchen. All right, so I'm doing this series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist. And all I really want to know is how you became the writer, how that happened to you, what the beginnings are like. Do you remember?
Of course. I knew by the age of 12 that I wanted to be a writer.
Really?
Nobody in my family wrote at all. Neither my mother just barely graduated from high school. My father did not. And there are no writer in my entire extended family, which
so
is very, very large.
So you're kind of an anomaly in the family.
Well, there are a number of anomalies, but I'm the writer who's an anomaly.
So by 12 you knew you wanted to be a writer.
Right. I started writing, yeah.
What did you start to write?
Oh, I wrote little sketches and pieces about neighbors. At the end of my 12th year, I was writing short stories. You know, they were very short, a couple of pages.
Do you remember what stimulated that? What?
I can only guess, because there are things that still stimulate that. One was reading. I read, even at that age, I read quite a bit. And there was a library, not very close by, but I would walk to the library, and I loved to read, and I didn't know what I was going to read. I just took books and, you know, one book at a time, had an interesting title and took them home and I read and read.
Fiction? Mostly fiction?
Yeah, it was fiction. It was all fiction at that time. But I have to give equal credit. That was early in television. Television was a big influence on me and the movies were an even bigger influence on me. The idea that somebody crafted this for the screen interested me, but what interested me more were the characters, and I wanted to create characters like that. My father read mystery magazines, and then didn't read novels, you know, just mystery magazine. They were around all the time, and I read those, and some of them I really liked. Some of the stories in them I liked a lot, but as I said, I read rather eclectically. Without thought about what was the quality of what I was reading. And it didn't matter to me. I enjoyed it. And then I just kept writing.
Did you keep what you wrote, or you just wrote it and...
I wrote it, and that was the end of it. The one time I wrote a story, and I hid the story in the leg of a sofa in our living room. Again, this is when I was about 12 years old. And my mother in cleaning found the story and read it and said, I had a meet with my father when he got home. And my father, a nice man, he was sitting at the table with my mother next to him, and he said, did you write this? And I said, yeah. He said, why do you hate Mitzi and her father so much? And I said, I don't hate them at all. I like them. And he said, why did you write this about them? And I said, it wasn't really about them. I just sort of picked them for a story. The way, you know, like you read the stories. And he said, and my mother was there very nervous about this because they were neighbors with that thing. Uh-huh. And my father said, promise me you're never going to write again stuff like this again. And I promised him, but I didn't pay any attention.
Well, I mean, this is the kind of thing that might have stopped somebody.
I don't see how, if someone were really determined and it was in them, I don't think it would have stopped anybody.
Well, and that, of course, is the question that I'm always interested in, that it's in you.
I think so.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell stories. It wasn't that I wanted to be, I did want to be a writer, but the reason I wanted to be a writer is because I wanted to tell stories.
And you have seemingly an inexhaustible source of stories.
It should be inexhaustible. Yes, it is inexhaustible.
I'm absolutely in awe of what you, of just what I know of what you've written, of what I've read of what you've written. It seems never to end.
Well, it will end when I end, and that'll be it.
Well, no, it won't either.
No, it'll, what I've already written will still be there, but there won't be anything new.
Well, we don't know. For all we know, you'll reincarnate and start again.
I'm not sure what I would reincarnate as. my wife has some thoughts about that. I don't.
Okay, so, all right, we have you at 12 with this irresistible urge to read and write.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And
it caused me trouble later in my
life,
too.
That was my question. So you want to tell me about that?
Oh, yeah. By the time I went to college on a soccer scholarship to the University of Illinois. I was on the wrestling team. I was a jock, a small jock.
That's pretty amazing. And just let me stop you for a second. These things are not usually, they don't usually go together.
Sure they do.
An irresistible desire to read and write and to be a jock.
John Irving, was a college wrestler, and he's a terrific writer.
Well, there's another myth blown then that these things don't go together.
I think it's possible for them to go together. They don't have to.
Right.
But there are a number of writers who were professional athletes and became good fiction writers. I really haven't thought about the athletic backgrounds of very many other writers. But often when I talk to them, I find out that, very often they did. You know, just as often they were, couch potatoes. But I wish there were some clear delineation or markers for it. I don't think there are.
No, I don't either. I just, I was being a little facetious, but I did think that, generally speaking, the life of the mind and the life of the body, you don't find that many people who have that with, any kind of equal passion. So, okay, you went to college on a soccer scholarship.
Yes.
And
I played. Initially, I went to school at the University of Illinois in Chicago, where I played. And I was a reasonably good student, and so it was a tough school because they wanted to kick everybody out. It was open enrollment, complete open enrollment. I did well, both playing soccer, and I engaged in other athletic things. I boxed very briefly. I hated it. I loved boxing, but I hated doing it. Weightlifting, I was a good competitive weightlifter at my weight. And I was a good student. Then I went to transferred to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana as a journalism student. And I barely got through because I just kept missing classes to read. My reading comprehension and interest suddenly jumped. And I don't know why, but there was a huge leap, and I just kept reading and reading and reading and not going to classes.
Like an obsession.
Yeah, oh, I'd stay in my room and I'd read. If I'd read one thing by James Jones, I want to read everything by James Jones. And I just kept reading and reading and missing classes, and I was called in a couple of times saying, do you really want to be a journalist? And I said, yeah, I really want to learn how to write. That's why I'm here. My grades in my English classes were all very good. My journalism grades were poor, even though I was a good writer and I was a good journalist, that's, I just kept missing classes and missing assignments. But I did make it through. Went into the Army. The Army was a good place for me to read. Once I got past basic training and was assigned to a post, and it was in Europe, it was a small post in Europe, I had plenty of time to continue reading. And I did. I went to graduate school at the University of Illinois. I was an English major. I got my PhD, and I am MA in graduate school. Then I went out to work. I was writing all the time. I wrote 5 novels before the first one was published. I worked for a community newspaper in Chicago. I liked that very much, but paid almost nothing. I did that. And then made a sudden leap. I applied for a job in university public relations with the University of Illinois and got hired, and that career took off. I mean, I was writing public relations pieces, articles, editing the newspaper in Chicago for the University of Illinois. And I did very, very, very well. And eventually, I was doing a lot of skipping because I was writing a lot at the time. I got 5 short stories published in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. magazine.
There's A Man from U.N.C.L.E. magazine?
Yeah, I've got copies of it somewhere. it was a decent magazine. I had 5 stories published. I had 1 story published in the New Mexico Quarterly. But, none of my novels caught on. And, as I said, I was working for University of Illinois at the Medical Center, and then got hired for 1 year to work for the University of Michigan, being the editor for their sesquicentennial publications. And I was lucky enough, the University of Chicago somehow saw the stuff I was done. I was doing it, a guy named Carl Larson, who was one of these iconic figures in the field. Liked my stuff, called me in for an interview, and hired me, and I came back to Chicago to work for the University of Chicago. I was writing all the time, and I started writing articles, ghosting articles for doctors, mostly research scientists. I did that, and I kept getting promoted there. I got promoted to the news editor, I got promoted to director of public relations, then I got promoted to assistant to the vice president for public affairs. And during that time, I met my wife. So I'm glad that came about. Let's see.
How old are you now?
74.
No, not today. I mean, at this time in your life.
Late 30s, I guess. Yeah.
And you still haven't had a novel published?
I didn't get a novel published until I was in my late 30s.
Really?
No, my mid-30s. I went back to graduate school to get a PhD at Northwestern. And that was a quirky thing, too, because I thought I was going to get a PhD in journalism and that I would become a journalism teacher because I had the experience. But they closed out their PhD program, and there I was accepted at at Northwestern University with no graduate program. They suggested that I walk over. It wasn't very far, to a building called Ida Mae Swift on campus, and I see a guy who was doing a PhD program in film. He immediately said, wonderful, just because I love movies.
Mm-hmm.
I knew so much about the history of film. I knew so many films. And I went to that PhD program.
So it was perfect. It was always waiting there.
Well, you see, I thought of that as fun. I never thought of that as something academic or something I could make a living out of. I just thought it was fun. I thought all my work on my PhD was fun. I thought writing my dissertation was great fun. It turned into a book that got published.
What was it on?
It was a biography, critical biography, of a director named Don Siegel. You'd know him because, let's see, he directed the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He directed John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart's last movie, The Shootist.
Mm.
He did Dirty Harry. In fact, that's when I went to California to meet him and to work with. I worked with him. He's very, very, very nice to me. Extremely nice to me. And that led to a book, nonfiction. And that led to another book that led to a book about Clint Eastwood, a biography of Clint Eastwood. And then I submitted a proposal to a publishing company in Chicago. And the proposal was not for fiction. The proposal was to do a biography of Charlton Heston. And the editor called me in and he said, the only biography we'd want would be an authorized biography, not an unauthorized biography. But he said, I like the way you write, and I'm quitting here to become an agent. And if you need an agent, I'd be happy to represent you. And he was my agent till fairly recently, many, 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 many years.
And how old were you then? Do you remember?
It was late 30s by then, mid to late 30s. I'm trying to remember.
So
I can figure it out exactly. Give me a moment. It'll just take a moment.
It's okay.
40. I was 38.
So you discover film in your mid-30s.
No, I did discover film. I discovered film when I was a kid.
No. I mean, you discover film as a potential area to make a living in.
Right. Yeah, it was
very late.
It was wonderful. The day I defended my dissertation, I was offered a job right there by the committee. And I took the job because I'd done a little teaching as a graduate, as a PhD candidate.
You mean to teach film?
To teach film at Northwestern. I got a job. I eventually went through the process. I kept writing and getting things
get
published.
I did get Charlton Heston,
and eventually I agreed to do
an authorized biography.
We had a publisher. And I'm getting to a point that's very important.
Yeah.
Remember, I'd written 6 books. I had given them all to this new agent that I had. I had this contract with a publisher to write this official biography. I worked on it for a year because I had had an advance on the book. And then one day I found out, almost conversationally talking to Charlton Heston, that he had agreed to publish his journals, edited version of his journals. The film editor at the university, at the New York Times, had convinced him to do that. He didn't think there would be any problem with my book.
Oh.
But the contract clearly said you can't do this. So there was a big meeting with lawyers and the whole business and my agent in Los Angeles. And I said, if he wants out, he wants out. It's his life. And they wrote me a nice check. And I went home and I had nothing to do. And nothing. I didn't have anything to teach. I didn't have another biography to write. I didn't have a textbook I was working on. So I sat down and I wrote a novel in 9 days. Just something I wanted to write about film, with a film background. Gave it to my agent, to whom I had promised never to write any more fiction, because he'd read my 5 novels. He didn't think they were all that good. But he thought I was good at writing nonfiction. He liked it very much and submitted it to only a few publishers. I can't remember. I think it was the 3rd publisher, St. Martin's. A guy who's still working there. St. Martin's liked it. Said they would gladly take it, but it was too short. So I had to write another chapter, which was no difficulty. And that was my first Toby Peters book, Bullet for a Star. And from that point on, I had no problem getting my fiction published.
This is amazing. And so you were 40 or something, right?
Uh-huh.
When you wrote the first Toby Peters book? Oh, my God. So what are you writing? Two books a year or something?
More.
God.
Raymond Chandler didn't start writing until his first novel when he was 51.
Oh, this is so wonderful. This is so reassuring. So tell us, because I don't know exactly, but you certainly do, how many Toby Peters books are there?
23.
And how many, is it Rostikov?
Mm-hmm.
How many?
I don't remember. I think it's 12. 12?
Maybe.
I've read them all.
And Lieberman's, I think it's close to the same number. And the Lufanescas, a short, I think it's six on Lufanescas.
You're writing
and two non-series books too. I've written two non-series novels.
I didn't read those. What are they?
Oh, I'll give you one.
Oh, okay, good. Because I'm pretty sure I've read everything.
The main character is modeled on Enid, based on Enid, and it's I think it's very good. Everybody got great reviews. Was made into films twice. It's been filmed twice.
What is it?
When the Dark Man Calls. It's very scary.
Very scary. Oh, very nice.
A woman being terrorized.
Oh, yeah, maybe I won't read it.
It's pretty good, right? It's good.
You'll read it, but you stay up all night while you read it.
Yeah, great. I'll wait until I get a dog.
Well, I did another one, too, that was made into a movie. Exercise of Terror. I wrote the screenplay for that one. It was filmed here in Sarasota.
Well, so this is so fascinating. I mean, clearly you know you're going to be a writer by the time you're 12.
I know I'm going to write. Mm-hmm.
But the thing for which you are best known doesn't happen until you're 40.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then it takes off like a rocket.
It picks up, yeah. But what I said was, from that point on, I could get published, anything published. The question is, how big was it and how much money did I make? So for quite a while, I was getting published, but nothing much was happening.
Right.
And it's only gradually that I got to the point where I am a comfortable mid-list writer. In other words, I can get anything, pretty much anything
published.
I can always get a contract, I think, to do fiction. I've never had a bestseller.
Really?
Nope.
That's astonishing, given the number of books out there and the quality. My God. Are you done with Rostov?
We check that every day, right?
I'll bet you do.
Can't we? We're dumbfounded by the people whose books are, and some of those people we know.
Yeah.
Dumbfounded.
And they're not nearly as good.
I don't think they even come close.
No, they're not. And I've read a lot of them, so I know. Are you going to write any more Rostov? I think I've asked you this before.
I've got another one. I've got one that came out in August.
Really?
This past August.
I thought you weren't going to do that anymore.
I didn't think so either, but I got an offer to continue them.
Good, I'd love them. Is he ever going to get out of there?
What?
Is he ever going to get out
of
there?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. How sad.
And I finished another one just the other day and sent it off. But that won't come out for about a year.
So you're still just churning them out?
Well, yeah.
Because I write, so the idea that there's an inexhaustible source of new storylines.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Do you have, like, a book of storylines that you can, you just sit down and it's there?
No, I sit down and write an outline. You know, I think about it for a long time while I'm doing something else,
mm-hmm.
while I'm writing another
one. Most of the time that looks like falling asleep in front of a basketball game on TV.
But that's what I do. Then I go, and after thinking about it for weeks, several weeks, sometimes longer, several weeks while I'm writing something else, I sit down and write out an outline. I usually do it longhand. And then I type, put it on the computer.
So you'll be working on more than one thing at a time?
No.
Well, I mean, in one way,
at a time.
Right? But your mind is working on another one.
As long as I know where the book I'm writing is going and how it's going to end, then I can think about the other thing.
Because you don't have to think about this anymore. It's just a question of putting it down.
I sit down there and it will come to life for me, and I don't have to worry about it.
It is really interesting that once you've sort of come to the place where you know what this book is about, then your mind can begin to gestate the other one. While your fingers are typing the first one, your mind is writing the second one, essentially.
Yeah, and you've read my book, so you know that each of my series, the voice is completely different.
That's right.
Completely different.
Right.
And I just go into that mode, and I have no trouble thinking that way.
Wow.
I think I've likened it to, and it's not quite right, actors.
I was just going to say that.
If you say, do Russian...
They do Russian.
They do it. They don't have to think about it.
No, they become it.
they become it.
Right, I was going to say it must be very similar to the process that actors go through. They inhabit the character, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's what you do, right? I mean, you move from Toby to Lou to, right?
Well, the way I work, some people work this way, I think they do. Probably because my background is in film, because I've always loved film since I was a kid. When I'm sitting and writing, I'm seeing it. I see it. Sometimes it's a little fuzzy, but I see it. I see the rooms. I see them moving. I see what they look like. So I know a lot of people, they don't think that way. It's there.
No.
And it's fine. And they write beautifully. But for me, I enjoy the process of, say, you know, thinking, oh, he walks across the room, opens the cabinet. He turns, he's standing, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I see it happening.
You see it happen, right. It's a movie for you.
Huh? Well, when students, you know, I had students or people come to me and ask me what they should learn. And I always say the most important thing you learn is typing. And then, well, what else? Spelling. And I mean it.
Yeah, I know.
And then grammar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then if you can reasonably master those, then when you're thinking of your stories, you'll have the tools for doing it. And if you can master typing and the imaginative process, spelling, that's not imaginative, spelling and grammar without thinking about them, then whatever's going on in your head,
it'll just come right out.
It'll be easier to get at them. It'll come out. You won't have to struggle.
Right, right.
To say what's, you know, I frequently say, when you say, when someone is writing, a new writer particularly, when you have to keep saying, thinking, what will she say next? What will he say next? Then you don't have it.
Then you don't have it. Right. No, because it's there or it's not there.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated with this because I didn't know, of course, and I just imagined that you'd been producing. I mean, because the body of work is so large. I mean, it's a lot of work in a very short period of time.
It's over 70 books.
In 30 years?
Yeah, I guess 30. No, right now it's like 38 years or something.
Well, not 40 to 70. Right? You started in about 40 and you're 73.
Right, 74, yeah.
So 34 years.
Yeah, okay.
So 70 books in 34 years is, I mean, it's like 2 a year or something?
Or three.
3 a year. It's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm down to 2 a year now. 2 a year in one play and usually two short stories.
Tell me about that. Didn't you just do a play in competition?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me
about
it.
Very successful. I was contacted by a Florida producer, Zev Buffman, who was also dipped on Broadway, contacted me out of the blue and said he was thinking of doing this film, this play festival in a town called Owensboro, Kentucky, and he wanted to know if I would help him, if I'd be interested in co-chairing this. I didn't know the guy, and I said, who else is on board? And he said, nobody. Just me, and I'm asking you. And I don't know why I said yes. I just said yes. And it mushroomed into this huge festival in which I did a play for the first year. There's competition now. They give a lot of money for the plays. Big stars come in. It's big now. I wrote a play. You know, based on something I'd done years ago at Northwestern. It's called Books. It was a comedy. And they produced it at the festival. It was nominated for an Edgar. Two years ago? Nominated for an Edgar. This old play I had done that I'd forgotten about. I just did it because they needed a play.
You must say that Zev Buffman, who was the...
I said he's brilliant.
Producer, did, but I don't believe he gave his name.
Yeah, he said Zev Buffman.
Is, could give producers a good name. He's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it was
dynamic.
St- staged as a radio play by a troupe that is...
Fire Sign Theater in California.
And they...
They got a star. They got Harry Anderson, you know Harry?
Yeah, you do.
The troupe...
I know who Fire Sign is.
Yeah, they're brilliant. They're wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harry was... I thought Harry was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It did extremely well. They asked me if I would write another play for the next year. And, you know, I'd written some Sherlock Holmes stuff. I'd written two published Sherlock Holmes books from official collections from the Conan Doyle family. Collections from the Conan Doyle family. And so I thought, you know, I'd play with one of the short stories I'd written, play with it a little bit, and expand it into a play, you know, coming up with other things and other twists and turns. Then they produced it, full-scale, Steppenwolf Theater production, actors, a terrific director from California, has his own theater.
Canada,
has his own theater in Calgary that only does mystery plays. And he was he was just wonderful, getting Mark Bellamy. Played it extremely well. I mean, a lot of people came. Some people came two or three times to see the play. And at every performance got a standing ovation at the end of the play.
Wow.
Not because I was so great, but because maybe what was happening, what I did at the end of the play sort of calls for people's emotions. I mean, it's very emotional. And it sort of asks for a response to get a response. Anyway, the president of Samuel French, you know what I'm saying?
I do.
He was there. Leon was there. He was waiting for me after the first production, first time it was produced, to offer me a contract to represent the play and the one I had done the rest of the year before, books. I said, you know, I have to go talk it over. When I came back, he was standing outside the theater. Went in the room, went into Zev's office, signed the contract. It was good advance, really good advance. And that was it. It is just going to, I'll show you copies of it. It's just been published in their own form that they sent. Mm-hmm. Really neat. It's being produced in Tacoma, Seattle at a regional theater in February, and we're going to go see that. So we're hoping, you know, it starts taking off because it's a good play for community theaters to do. It is.
And how many
even asked me, it's if you had to rate this, it would be, you know, a G-rated comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, we're hoping. I won the prize as best writer. It was a nice prize. How much did I get? Any $10,000?
For what?
Final toast.
12.5.
No. I meant for the prize. Prize was 10.
No, 5.
You sure?
Yeah.
Well, I got $5,000 for said.
How many acts?
What?
Is it 2 acts?
No, it's 2 acts. Mm-hmm. It's a short, full-length play. But the way they did it, they did a number of things. I was there for rehearsals and making changes. That was fun. Adding things depending for these particular actors. And a good give and take. And I really had a good time. The version that I finally came up with that the stage manager was putting together from what we were doing, little bits I was writing, I think is much better than the original play that I wrote. And what they produce is better than what finally produced is better than what I wrote. So I think it's a good play, really good play.
So I'm interested in this because this is such a collaborative thing you're describing.
For me, it's not always for playwrights, I understand.
No, and it certainly isn't for novelists.
Oh, no, novels on your own.
Right, you're on your own.
For playwrights, if you're there, you're dealing with these people, and I like the give and take. I don't feel super proprietary about it. It's, you know, once I've written it, they've accepted it, and my feeling is it's ours. I will project it to the extent that I think they're doing something that's hurting it. But if they're not,
no, and it's in nobody's interest for them to hurt it, so they wouldn't want to either.
I know now I know playwrights who I've met. I met a couple of pretty big playwrights. They can't stand having anybody change their play. Or they don't even want suggestions.
Wow. Well, you know, again, this is a. A sort of ID fix, but it seems to me that the capacity to write novels, you know, just all by yourself, this is yours, whatever you think, this is in it, you know, and the capacity to be collaborative in the way you're describing, they don't always go together in the same person, so it's really...
I think there's such a huge difference between writing novels and writing plays, and getting, you know, the book is the end product for the novelist, and the production is the end project for the playwright.
Yes, that's right.
For me, as a novelist, I write the book, I submit it to my editor, I make suggestions or changes. I can argue with them, I can even refuse it, and then we'll go, you know, keep it going.
Well, and when it's done, it's in stone.
It's done. And it's all over.
But, you know, I'm also thinking, you know, you've written for film a lot and TV, and mm-hmm. that stuff's very collaborative.
What has happened to me generally, writing for film and television, I knew this because I was a film teacher. I'd been on sets. I knew people in the film and television industry before I wrote for it. My feeling was, I write it because I know what's going to happen. I write it. I give it to them, and I get out of the way, and they'll do with it whatever they want to do with it.
Right.
Can you get that? Then I get out of the way. If they want me there, they want input, fine. But I don't expect what will appear on the screen, small or large, is going to have a great resemblance to what I
wrote.
I get paid nicely, very nicely for doing it. And you know, if I'm lucky enough, it's close to what I wanted.
Yeah.
Usually for film and television, when they make changes, it's different from theater where I'm there actually to work with. I generally don't like the changes that were made on my work for film or television. And sometimes I hate it. Occasionally I'll be really pleased with it, but very rarely.
Yeah.
Very rarely. But that's what I expect.
But again, as you say, you know, you're not proprietary about it, or whether
Oh, no, I can't. Not. It's silly to be. I know people who have been, and
no, it's a setup to be disappointed.
In film and television, you're hired to write it. You write it. And that's it. Get out of the way.
It's a skill.
Go home.
Right. It's a skill. It's a.
Yeah.
It's a craft. It's you've had an assignment. You do the assignment. That's it.
Yeah. You could, for television, you could. I have friends who write for television have for many, many, many years. You have a meeting. I'm not a part of that. I don't want to be part. You have a meeting. I've been in movie meetings. I don't like those at all. I've been in a lot of those. But for television, you have this core of people. They sit around for the weekend, and they decide what the storylines are going to be for the next, I mean, like the 3 weeks ahead or whatever it's going to be. Or if it's for the whole season, they decide. And then they assign them. And you get assigned it, and you write it. The faster you write it, the better. My feeling is it should be no more than a week, probably 4 days, to write it 1 hour, and get it back to them. And if they don't like something, they want changes, they let you know. But in television, if they do that, they have to pay you again, because I'm a Writers Guild member. They have to.
They have to pay
you
for the changes.
They can't just say change this. We don't like it. Fine. I'm going to change it. They're going to pay me. I know that. Mm-hmm. So I'll make as many changes as they
like.
I'll keep going making changes. But the process stops at one point. At which point, if it still gets to a point where they don't like it after a while, then they can dump me and get somebody else. But I understand that process. It's fine.
The other thing that you have done a lot in the last few years is the film lectures.
It's not, that's different from teaching film. It's quite different. Because the film talks I give, and I've done them here in Sarasota for a number of years. I've done things like that. You know, obviously, throughout my career, after I got my PhD, I spoke to lots of groups about film. Some of them very large, and lot of it was give and take. But this series I did in Sarasota was for adults, and it was not, you know, it wasn't mandatory. They came because they saw the movie that we were going to discuss, and very good groups for discussion. I enjoyed it very, very much. I did have to do some preparation for each one of them, but that was fine because I learned more about the movies and, you know, who did them and what was going on. I'm not doing them anymore.
No, I know. I know, but it was, they were wonderful.
Thank you.
They were wonderful. They were not like anything else I have ever seen, you know. And you say something that I believe absolutely, and I don't, and you always get people to argue with you about it, about the relative merits of things, that things are neither good nor bad, but that you think they are. And I've heard you say that, and I've heard people argue with you about it. And
I unfortunately for them, I can beat them because part of my studies have been, you know, I took courses on the history of aesthetics and the history of criticism, literary criticism, not film criticism, theater criticism. And when, you know what I always say, I say, okay, what is the criteria for good and bad? Find me any place in the world where anybody can come up with concrete. But we are human beings. The only thing you can say is God gave them to us. If you won't say God gave you these things, then there's no, you can't say, you can't do it.
Yeah. I'm always happy when I hear you do that with people because I...
No, people get very angry.
I know they do. I know.
Because they believe that they know.
Yes.
They believe that it's very clear that what's a good book and what isn't a good book, who's a good writer, who's not a good writer. They're just flat out wrong.
I know. I know. I agree with you entirely.
You know, you get to be an adult, you know, adult over the age of 50, some, you know, even younger than that. That's hard for an adult to face.
Yeah.
It's really hard for them. Kids, it's easier. The kids do the same thing. College kids did the same thing.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They'd fight about it. But they got over it.
Well, it's this idea that there must be something that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the
there must be some criteria. And what I tended to do is say, only at the furthest reaches of something being so god-awfully done.
That everyone will agree.
And if you want to, you know, that we'll have consensus on that at least.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it anything.
It just means we have consensus.
The consensus is that this is terrible. But almost everything else you're not going to find.
Even that.
You can't find that.
No,
and nor should you.
No, I think that's right. And I'm always happy to see you doing the defending of that.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed that. I like fighting with people.
You do. Yeah.
Yeah, I really do.
Yeah, well, you do it well.
Keeps me going and helps me think on my feet.
Well,
when I spend so much time sitting at a computer.
Yeah.
And just having things in my head.
But again, you know, the thing that's so interesting to me about you is how many, what I would have thought of as opposites you are.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, the first thing I said was, you know, the life of the mind, the life of the body. Okay, maybe there are a lot of people who do that, but that's not a common kind of thing. So there we have those opposites. Then we have, you know, the fact that you can work in solitude, you can work in, you know, the single-minded, this is my work, never mind, and then you can work in collaboration just as easily, you know, take it, leave it, change it, I'm fine about that. And then the, this sort of, again, the life of the mind, you know, where you're either producing something that you've thought through or you're gestating something that you're going to produce, and the guy who likes the interaction, the fight, I mean, these things all are...
Yeah. And I love working with... I love working with the producers of my plays, and I love working with the actors. I really like that.
Yeah, you pretty much love everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm rather eclectic. Maybe Maybe I would have been more successful had I been more
single-minded.
Directed, but I don't know. Probably not.
No, but you wouldn't have produced what you have produced.
Oh, no, of course not.
Oh, my God, and the body of work is astonishing. It really is astonishing, Stuart. I mean, maybe it doesn't feel like that to you, but it really is.
No, it doesn't. I know people who are as prolific or more prolific than I am, yes.
Do you want to keep doing that? I want to keep telling you that it's wonderful, it's special, and you want to keep telling me that other people do it.
No, well, I assume you're including a qualitative element in that acknowledgement of the large body of my body. Where the other people I know who produce such large quantities are not necessarily...
Well, the quality is not necessarily... Well, I agree,
it's not,
you know.
Not necessarily.
I mean, I've read, I'm pretty sure, all of the Rostikoffs and all of the Toby Peters. I mean, they could not be more different.
Very different.
You know, and I mean, to inhabit those two worlds in the way that you do, and they're consistent, and they're true, and they're, you know, and then the other two series, I've read some of the Sarasota series, not all, right?
Mm-hmm. And new one comes out in January.
Yeah. I mean, that's remarkable.
Thank you. I think you'll hear another voice when you read the two non-series books. Both of those, one of them, the first one, When the Dark Man Calls, came about when I was criticized. Actually, it was a favorable review, as I recall. But they criticized me for only being able to see through the eyes of men. And I decided I'm going to write a book completely from the perspective of a woman. I'm going to make it scary. And I did. It was a very successful book, When the Dark Man Calls. It's all about this woman, and it stays with her. And that was successful. And then the other one I wrote, Exercise of Terror, which was also a film completely from the perspective of the female protagonist.
So all you need is to be challenged, right?
It's imagination. So when people say, you can't do this, you can't do that, If you can imagine, you can imagine.
Yeah.
I can imagine how this woman felt. I can imagine what she was thinking. I can imagine what it felt like physically to be her. And,
it's what a writer is.
I did it. And that sort of ended that. You know, that criticism.
But you don't have to do that anymore.
Well, I'd be willing, but I'm not going to do a non-series book without a contract.
Well, no, my gosh, you certainly don't have to do anything on spec ever again.
No, no, I don't. I did write a screenplay, which I've talked to my agent about at great length. He came and we talked about it and we rehashed it. We have a slight disagreement. I think it's ready to go. He doesn't think it's ready to go and I should turn it into a novel. Instead, I've got it in the hands of a producer. No, I think it's a very, very good screenplay. It's semi-historical. It's about... it's set in Nazi Germany in 1940. Mm. And it has a film background. 1940. And it's a thriller. It's a thriller with, I think, some poignancy and meaning behind it. Because, and I'll tell you a little about it, I don't think anybody's going to steal my idea. It's about Joseph Goebbels wants a film made, an anti-Semitic film made to show at Hitler's birthday, because Hitler's birthday is coming up. And he wants, in the role of the Jews, because it's about a trial, based on a real trial of Jews, he wants Jews.
He wants the real
Jews. A Jewish central figure has to be the bad guy. Well, 1940, it's tough to find Jewish actors of quality. And he's picked a director. He's gotten a director. He's ordered this director, who's internationally famous director, who's now going to go out and find a terrific Jewish actor. And that's sort of the premise.
It's a great idea. Yeah.
And, of course, he does find somebody. But finding that somebody and the guy he finds is a real problem, major problem. But it's fun, and then it's a thriller. Obviously, for me, the Nazis do not win.
Yes, no, no,
I'm not trying.
No. All right, we're gonna need to. You know, I'm having such a good time. I forgot about time, and What I'm needing to... Oh, stop. Oh, okay, good. I'm going to have enough time to get home, which is what I need to do. But,
The thing I should tell you, the thing I'm working on now, because I'm between books, I was asked to do there's a little booklet series which put out, in which authors, well-known authors, I can show you the series, are asked to do 5,000-word biographies of one of their main characters. So I'm working on a Toby Peters biography, because that's the one I know best. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Oh, that's lovely. I would love to read
that. Get that done. I've only got about 1,000 words done so far. But it's fun. You know, even for me to... Now I've got to think about that long period that's only a little vague to me before my series...
Starts.
Yeah, it starts when
what was he doing?
It starts when he's in his 40s.
Right, and this is... He's
and
no
I, mentioned,
longer,
I mentioned a few things about his earlier life, but now...
Right, I'm right, right, right. So this... It starts after he's a cop. He's already no longer a cop when it starts, right?
My series started that.
Right.
But the biography's going to start...
That's what I mean. So you have to... Right.
With his birth.
Right. Oh, God, and all that...
And maybe... And I've got a trick that I know this guy who publishes these things is going to love. His mother... You'll figure this out. His mother... I never mentioned anything
I
about
know. I was just going to ask about that.
Well, his mother was a Lieberman. That I know.
That's great.
I know. So
that's
he's actually
great.
Related to
that's
Ava.
Great. That's terrific.
Yeah.
I love it.
I've never used that. I never...
Oh,
that sort of came to me.
You know there'll be a book in this. The book before. Oh, yes, there will.
Well, there might be.
Of course there will. I would want to read it. Anybody who's read the series will want to read
well,
it.
Well, he can't meet Abe because they're from different times.
No, that's okay. He doesn't have to. But whatever it is that you're discovering about his early life, you know. Oh,
and
that's great.
You know, I mentioned that his mother is from Chicago. And that her family is still there.
Oh, it's lovely.
I'm not going to give...
No, just the hints. Just people who know will know.
Yeah, I'll hint.
Yeah, right.
Give the hint. So it's fun. I'm having fun writing it.
So now do this for me, because is there anything that you would want to say about writing, about art, about your life, about anything you would want to communicate about what it means to be an artist in this culture or anything?
Well, a couple of things. One of them is very pragmatic. I don't believe in initiating the whole process because you want to make money. Because if you're at the beginning of your career and you're trying to do that, you're all, not completely, but you're almost certainly doomed to failure. Mm-hmm. And then you're also doomed, if you're successful, and I know a number of people have had big time first books that have been promoted highly. What do you do then? If it's not your imagination that's driving you, what do you do then? So, you know, that would be a piece of advice that I have for people. And I do believe that if it's in you, it's in you. It can be nurtured in people, but if you don't have it, you don't have it.
I think that's...
It's nice to have somebody who's eventually a mentor or supports you. I had somebody at the University of Illinois who recognized I was a writer before. You know, I could be a professional writer before I did. But I would have persevered even if he had not sort of discovered me. Yeah.
You know, I want to end here because I think that's so right. And this reminds me of, you know who Betty Garrett is?
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She was the love of the guy, somebody on Northwestern's faculty, a British guy. He loved Betty Garrett. He wore an I Love Betty Garrett t-shirt.
You're kidding.
And she came to Northwestern.
Oh, she's a friend of mine. I will remind her of that when
Patty Winnell.
Patty
Winnell at Northwestern. She'll know him.
I will.
Patty Winnell, he's a Scotsman.
And Betty says that, you know, if she had not been successful, she'd be dancing in corners. Wherever she was, she'd just be dancing.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know.
The last thing, it's about to be the last thing. I went to interview Mickey Spillane, who I'd known for a long time.
Wow.
And I admire him. And, you know, he was I write for money type of guy. That's what he always said. And for some reason, in Merle's Inlet, we had to put something in the trunk of his car. and he opened the trunk of his car, and it was full of manuscripts that he'd written that have never been published. Clearly, the man had this drive. He could not stop. Even though his patter was, I only write to make money, he had written all these things.
Yeah, right.
And they were in the trunk of his car.
That's a great story.
Yeah, that's true.
That is a great story, and it is. And he did box, didn't he, Mickey?
No, he was not a box. He was a
pilot.
Wasn't
he something?
He was a pilot.
Ah, I got that one.
And he trained pilots in Florida, right in this area, at Lakeland, and a little bit in around Sarasota.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was post-war. He was in the war. He was in World War II as pilot. He trained pilot. He had learned to I'm not going to give you a lot, Mickey. He had learned to fly when he was a kid. That's what he wanted to do his whole life. And he walked to an airfield near where he lived, harassed them until they taught him how to fly. He was a kid when he learned how to fly, 14 years old. And so he knew how to fly when the war came.
There he was.
There he was as a teacher of flying. And that's what he thought he was going to do until he decided one day he was going to write the book.
For money.
It worked for him.
It sure did.
His first book was one of the biggest bestsellers of all time. But he had plenty of ideas, so clearly a trunk full of ideas.
Maybe we can do this another time and you can tell me more stories.
Okay, I'd be happy to.
This is great. Thank you so much, Stuart.
You're very, very welcome to that. I enjoyed it.
I did, too.
I never got a chance to do that other interview, so I never got to hear all the rest of those stories. There isn't very much more I want to say in this show. I want to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do. And I want to say that I hope that this interview was of significance to you. And that I'll be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't.